Coming up on Tech News Today, LinkedIn loses almost half its value in one single day. Broken iPhones have some bad news and then also some good news there. Super Bowl I is unearthed and you may never see it. The HTC Vive is as good as you may think and so much more. Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1444, recorded Friday, February 5th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox is dedicated to making smart, delicious snacking easy. They have over 100 ridiculously delicious snacks that get delivered directly to your doorstep. Visit naturebox.com/twit to get 50% off your first box now.
And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/TNT.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about all the tech news with people who are passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell. And boy, it was kind of a slow news day today, would you say?
It was.
You kind of feel that way?
Yeah, I kind of feel like, well, you know, some editors might say a slow news day is we didn't work hard enough, but I don't agree with those people. We worked very hard.
We worked our tails off.
We did.
And mm-hmm.
We have no more tails.
I mean, we found stuff. Mm-hmm. We went digging. We dug all the corners mm-hmm. around the studio, and we unearthed plenty of stories to talk about. So I think we'll be all right. Not to mention, we have a pretty awesome guy joining us today, Jeff John Roberts from Fortune. How's it going, Jeff?
Real good, guys. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's fantastic to get you on. Tell people a little bit about kind of your beat at Fortune and what you write about mostly.
I write about lawsuits and regulation. Unfortunately, since it's tech, these companies are always getting sued by someone or other or suing each other. And I write about intellectual property, privacy, lots of stuff that starts with a P. But for law and tech, for short.
Excellent. I think we have a little bit of that in today's mm-hmm. stories.
Yep.
So let's get right to it. First and foremost, LinkedIn is apparently at the ropes, holding on as it takes a beating after it announced its earnings today, which is kind of surprising when you hear the beginnings here. LinkedIn actually beat expectations on earnings as well as revenue for Q4 of 2015. It's its guidance, its forward kind of looking guidance that's less promising. That hit pretty far below what the expectations were set at. And with that, stock tanked 40%. In one day, you lose almost half the value of the company. LinkedIn's worst day ever since going public in 2011. Not a good start for the day. Not a good start for the weekend, let's say, for people working at LinkedIn right now.
No, I mean, I don't really follow LinkedIn. We talked about this, you know. When I look for a job, I do. But, you know, as a company, it's been around for so long. But it does seem to be like, I guess their user growth is really going in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Jeff?
LinkedIn, I always thought was sort of invulnerable because they have the three revenue streams. I mean, they've got for headhunters use it. There's a premium thing for job services and then advertisements, too, with the content. But also, I hate LinkedIn. You know, there's other social networks that I like to go on. I like Twitter, I like Facebook, I like Snapchat. But the user experience on LinkedIn has always been awful. And maybe, just maybe, it's caught up to them. I don't know. Do you guys enjoy LinkedIn?
I don't know. It's one of those services that I'm on and that I use primarily because I think I need to be on it and use it every once in a while, but it's not something I check every day. I mean, I'm happily employed, you know, and maybe that's a big part of it is that LinkedIn is very essential for certain business, for certain career. Like I had a friend that was in town a couple of weeks ago. She works in marketing. And I mean, she was telling me how essential LinkedIn is to that business. And, you know, it's just a primary part of how you find a job and how you stay connected with people and all that kind of stuff. Whereas, you know, speaking of what we do, it's like a lot less important. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if maybe that, you know, that's part of what's kind of holding it back is that it's really, there are certain people that it applies wholly to. And then there are other people that it's way less important to their existence, essentially.
Right. And the user experience, you bring that up. I mean, I totally agree with you. They have done some really weird things. I mean, of course, everyone always jokes about the, you know, someone has looked at your profile on LinkedIn, those ridiculous emails that we got forever, or any time you went and updated anything, like it would spam all of your contacts, which was just horrible. And also just the, you know, it has a slightly creepy side to it, you know, where you can't actually see what, you know, who looked at your profile, which I think in this day and age, those are really sort of old fashioned kind of things that you think that they would know better at this point. So I think you're right. Maybe that's just catching up to them.
But also it's an editorial platform. Remember the story a couple of years ago is you'd have all these influencers and you'd go there to start your day and use it as a place to read and have fun on. And a lot of people, including those who work there, have said just their design and the user experience, if you wanted to go there for editorial stuff, is awful. And I really agree. It's just, but since they had the monopoly for so long, I guess they assumed they could get away with it. But maybe now it's caught up to them.
Well, it's interesting that you had mentioned their ad network as one of their three kind of driving forces. LinkedIn's also shutting down its ad network. Basically, this is something that began a year ago. It had purchased the ad tech firm Bezo. And so basically, they're just saying that the costs of managing that business just kind of weren't sustainable long term as it was scaling. And so they're going to kind of fold that ad tech into their sponsored ad content instead. So they're kind of peeling that back as well. And then finally, also announced today during the earnings call, and I just kind of had to feel bad for them. That's why I'm bringing them up, is Connectifier, a startup that LinkedIn announced it acquired during the earnings statement. You got to feel kind of rotten if you work for a company that is kind of, you know, announced on the same day that all of this really bad news kind of hits the forefront. So poor people at Connectifier. I don't know. Maybe they're happy. I don't know.
Maybe that'll be the thing to turn them around.
Yeah. It's basically, what is Connectifier? It's technology for recruiters for finding talent. So, I mean, obviously, if it's directly into what some people find is the, you know, kind of the upside for LinkedIn, their strength. So.
Well, moving on, The Guardian reports that Apple has admitted that the dreaded Error 53 that can brick your iPhone, they've admitted to it, that it exists. So Apple officials say it's there by design and it's meant to protect you. Error 53 happens whenever someone tries to upgrade their phones to iOS 9 if they have previously had their Touch ID sensor, that's the home button, fixed by a third party. Now, Apple says the error, which has no warning and no fix, will permanently disable your phone. A lot of people had their speak that Apple presented about this. It was very confusing. Rene Ritchie reached out to them, and their response to him was a little bit more clear. It said iOS checks that the Touch ID sensor in your iPhone or iPad correctly matches your device's other components. If iOS finds a mismatch, the check fails and Touch ID, including for Apple Pay use, is disabled. And this security measure is necessary to protect your device and prevent a fraudulent Touch ID sensor from being used. So that makes sense. I guess we would like that. I mean, that, you know, that is part of, you know, if you imagine how much you have on your phone and how much Apple has riding on Touch ID, from a legal perspective, I would guess, Jeff, like they want to protect this as much as possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they have a legal obligation to, but I assume that's what they're trying to do, because Apple is pretty good at security overall. And I think it was well-intentioned. But and I've heard about this, but how prevalent was this? Was this just like, you know, 10 or 20 people, or was this thousands of people?
I think there were a decent amount of people kind of hitting on this as the next update kind of came out for iOS. So
yeah, I don't think
it wasn't
they came up with numbers, but I mean, the idea was that if you went to a third party and got your phone fixed from them, you know, which some people do just because it's cheaper. But then they had one story, a Guardian reporter in the Balkans, he was covering the refugee crisis and he needed to get his phone fixed, and there are not Apple stores in Macedonia. So he had to get it fixed, and then he lost everything on his phone because of this. So, I mean, I thought it was interesting. I think to some extent, the third party person fixing it is a little bit on the hook there. I mean, if they should know that, you know, if someone comes and says, my Touch ID isn't working, that, you know, that they shouldn't mess with that, because, you know, you have to bring it to an Apple store. Otherwise, your phone's going to be bricked. I mean, they know now, hopefully.
Yeah, I know where I got the thousands number. That's actually related to the iFixit website they have a specific page around Era 53. They've gotten 183,000 hits to that. So you have to imagine, like, I don't know what that translates into actual users having problems, but, you know, it seems like it's not insignificant. You can understand, though, like you said, you understand the intention here, not having some sort of a warning about it. Also, you know, so that's kind of lame, but Apple has kind of historically not wanted you to necessarily fix your phones through third parties. Mm-hmm. So this could be kind of a backdoor way of saying, well, you know, I told you so. Like, you have to come to us because, hey, isn't it convenient? This is, you know, really insecure if we let other people fix this problem. So I don't know. I know on Android, if you root Android, things like Android Pay will not work on a rooted device. So there's similar protection measures in there, but yeah, it's not quite the same. This seems like an overcorrection, possibly, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, Apple's always had their phones more locked down, you know, than Android phones have been generally. So it does seem like, yeah, why does it have to completely lose everything? Like, you can't get it back.
Yeah, I know. That's
why can't you get it back?
Yeah. There should be some sort of recourse. Mm-hmm. Speaking of fixing broken iPhones, half the phones that I see in people's hands, not just iPhones, kind of seem to have cracked screens. Well, Apple is planning to cater to those unfortunate souls by extending its iPhone trade-in program to compensate for iPhone users with cracked screens. Currently, the plan only allows for older iPhones to be traded toward purchase of a new device. This would be a credit for damaged displays, cameras, buttons. So they're kind of extending it a little bit further for damaged devices within reason, and to be given for iPhone 5S, 6, and 6 Plus. So anywhere between $50 to $250 worth of trade-in value for that. So good news for all the people that are cracking screens. It's now a reason to upgrade to the next device because Apple will hook you up, I suppose.
They'll also offer plastic screen protectors and help you put them on the way out.
Yes. I mean, show of hands, have we all tried to put on these screen protectors before? They are such a pain in the butt. Yeah, so that's good.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, Apple's really pushing us to upgrade. They have, you know, the iPhone Forever plan. But, you know, the secret behind that is if you break your phone or if you don't have that phone, if you lose it, it is no longer, you know, you can't just walk in there and said, you know, you gave me one last year, now give me another one. Like, you have to present that phone back to them. Yeah. So I think maybe this is just what they're saying. Like, well, we'll take damaged phones. Probably not for the same, you know, you can't, it's not going to be a one-to-one trade, but they're offering us something.
Sure.
Well, according to a report from Mobile Syrup, BlackBerry is laying off around 1,000 workers. But they were telling the press that the number is much lower. Reporters at The Verge talked to representatives from BlackBerry who say that the layoffs affect approximately 200 employees in Canada and Florida. So BlackBerry, you know, they have the BlackBerry Priv, which had some mixed reviews, but it's still coming out on all carriers. So it's, you know, it's not a failure necessarily. So it's but it's sad for the people that are laid off. But I don't know if this, do you think this signals again the end of BlackBerry?
I don't know if it signals the end of BlackBerry, but it could signal kind of a focusing effort on their part. You know, like one big thing that they've been working on over the years is their own OS, you know, their own operating system for BlackBerry devices. And now they're really kind of going in the direction of Android and seemingly becoming a lot more dedicated to this. This could just be, you know, a sign of you know, even further lessening their kind of reliance on updating and keeping up to date the BlackBerry 10 platform.
What I want to know is what's going on with his Ryan Seacrest keyboards. Do you guys remember that?
Yes, typo. That was typo.
You plug into your iPhone, and then I think they won the patent case against typo. And to me, I'm still waiting for that because that's the only time I think of BlackBerry is I still miss the keyboard.
Yeah, that was the typo. That's right. That was back in 2015 when the lawsuit basically stopped the sale of typo. There it is. There it is.
Yeah, I want that.
You want that for your iPhone.
Were you a BlackBerry? Yes. I presume you're not. I don't want to presume anything, Jeff. Are you a BlackBerry user now?
No, I haven't seen one in the wild for years, but I do miss the keyboard.
Yeah, Apple just taught me not to think about the keyboard anymore, like the physical keyboard. Just you know, they put that bug in my brain that says, you never had a physical keyboard on your phone. You don't need it.
Well, the Priv seems to be doing okay. Like, more and more I'm seeing these reports of people that are, you know, basically saying, like, I gave it an actual honest honest to goodness chance, and I actually have really grown accustomed to having that keyboard back, having the BlackBerry experience back. BlackBerry, just as a company, just kind of seems like it's in a constant state of, you know, rediscovering itself right now. And I don't know. I mean, you probably could have guessed that this was going to happen at some point, that they were going to have to kind of lay some people off, but I don't necessarily think it's doom and gloom. Mm-hmm. They just have to find, you know, the big challenge if they do focus on Android is how do they compete? Because there are so many other Android manufacturers out there. Everybody's competing on the same space. BlackBerry definitely has its legacy in hardware and hardware keyboards and being really good from a security standpoint for businesses and all that kind of stuff. If they can figure that out, then they might actually have something. This just might be an effort to focus in on that. Twitter took to its blog today to illustrate what it's been doing to keep terror talk and extremist groups off of the social network. Some 125,000 ISIS-related accounts have been banned since mid-2015, says Twitter on their blog post, due to promotion. Well, they were banned because of promotion and threats of terrorist acts. They kind of let people in a little bit, and as far as like how effective their system has been, it's a little bit of human involvement, a little bit of technology kind of combined. They flag, eliminate the accounts, and 125,000 is not an insignificant amount of accounts to take out. Jeff, do you think this is a good start? Do you think they're obviously on the right path at this point?
I'm always going to be torn on Twitter because I really miss the old Twitter when they had that great general counsel, a guy named AMAC, who was let every voice speak, and they really were really good on the First Amendment and free speech issues. Mm-hmm. But then with the rise of ISIS, I mean, I guess you just have to draw some lines. And this is Congress is sort of really getting in their business to put a stop to this, understandably. So yeah, it's good. You know, I want ISIS to die like the rest of us, but also, you know, you guys sort of wonder, is it going to swing too far the other way? And after this, who else are they going to shut down? So I want the end of ISIS too, but you know, it's hard to cheer this stuff too hard.
Sure.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm totally torn on Twitter too. I both love it and hate it, and I want the free speech to go on, but you know, there's ISIS and then there's harassment and there's all these things that, you know, it's really hard. It's difficult. So I think it's interesting. They released these numbers for the first time. They don't have to, and they don't have to break out, like Facebook will say how many takedown notices they have, but they don't break out how many, you know, how much that has to do with terror. So, I mean, I think definitely they were trying to do a little PR, like, look what we're doing. It was 125,000. The New York Times points out that they don't know if those people have just immediately opened new accounts, which anyone who has ever been harassed on Twitter knows that that's what people do. It's very easy. You know, your account, and you make a new one, and you make a new one, and you know, Twitter's not great at stopping that. So, you know, it will be interesting, and I don't know how you're going to do it, you know, an algorithm.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what the type of accounts are. Like, a lot of these, from what I was gathering from the blog post, you know, there are a lot of kind of like automated accounts that are kind of putting out, you know, constant messages that are very easy for like spam bots to detect, you know, those types of patterns. So if it's an account like that opens up somewhere else and starts saying, you know, spreading the same types of information, the types of patterns and everything like that, spam bots can effectively kind of hone in on those at least a little bit easier. So that might make their job a little easier anyways.
And the other thing is, I mean, if you've ever talked or heard journalists talk about who've gone in and tried to like infiltrate ISIS and figure out what their recruitment processes are, they do it through Twitter. Like, that's how they get in touch with them, and it's surprisingly easy to do. And so it's interesting that, you know, if they just get rid of these accounts, what does that do to law enforcement and people studying this, people figuring out what ISIS recruitment techniques are? If, you know, all those accounts just immediately disappear, then they're not going to have that access, which the access might be a way in to these secret groups. And so that's also something to think about when you say, like, well, great, get rid of them all. So, you know, and there's also two things that we're talking about here, too. It's like, these aren't the encrypted networks where, you know, a lot of these Twitter accounts, you can't find the people, but you can see what they're tweeting. So that's different than what a lot of politicians say, like, we need to get rid of these, you know, encrypted networks. Mm. That's slightly different. That's something different, I think. And I don't know if Twitter really made that clear in their announcement today.
Sure. All right. Let's.
Well, yeah. Up next, we will look at a few stories that Jeff's been working on, plus our weekly gaming roundup with Sam Moscovich. But first, let's take a minute to thank NatureBox. All right, Jason, you ready to play a game?
I don't know. Okay. Depends on the game.
It's a good game. You can play it at home. You can play at home too. You can just shout out that answer at your computer or your TV or your smartphone or whoever you watch or listen to this show. I love shouting things at podcasts when I'm listening to them. So hopefully you out there do too.
I've got cliff notes right here. By the way,
Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps or pistachio power clusters.
Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps.
Okay. Okay. Sweet blueberry almonds or honey barbecue crunch?
Sweet blueberry almonds, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Garlic plantains or whole wheat chocolate chip cookie bites?
Chocolate chip cookie bites. All you had to say was cookie.
Okay. Well, the best part of this game is that you don't have to choose. You can have all of these snacks delivered right to your door when hunger strikes. Don't reach for that half-eaten bag of chips. Be prepared with smart and delicious snacks from NatureBox. All of NatureBox's snacks are made with high-quality ingredients that you can trust. Trying to eat healthier doesn't mean giving up on flavor. They have vegan, they have no sugar added, and non-GMO options. You can choose between savory, sweet, salty, and tart. Choose from over 100 unique and tasty options like golden apple tea biscuits and sriracha roasted cashews. Plus, you can fill out your snack profile and get personalized recommendations based on your preferences. The best part, NatureBox delivers right to your door. Fuel your game engine this weekend with healthy snacks. Visit naturebox.com/twit to get 50% off your first box now. That's naturebox.com/twit. Go there, get 50% off your first box of delicious personalized snacks sent directly to your doorstep.
Thank you, NatureBox. All right, so hey, Jeff, you've written a couple of very interesting stories this week. One that we read a couple of days ago, and we're like, yeah, he's going to be on Friday, so let's save it and talk to him a little bit about this then. This is the Apple story about Apple's $625 million verdict on Wednesday, where the company is ordered to pay for what the court found to be patent infractions related to its FaceTime app. Tell us a little bit about what's going on here exactly.
This is crazy. I mean, this is one of the highest, I think, top 5 or 10 patent verdicts ever. Like $625 million. Like even Apple's going to notice that. But if you know the backstory at all, it's part of the patent troll problem where a shell company, usually a bunch of lawyers, buys some old patents and then starts suing people. And the way it gets so lucrative is because where was the verdict? Where else? East Texas. It's this region of Texas that's where the industry is patent lawsuits. I mean, the local hotels are part of it. The local lawyers are. The local juror pool, in my opinion, is too, because, you know, it's the local economy. And so you've got 12 of these Texans who, you know, are just like, okay, let's award a $500 million verdict. Why not? I mean, Apple's losing it over this because the case doesn't look very strong, but it's just a sort of broken part of the legal system that's just struck again, but you know, in a fairly dramatic way this time.
Apple said that the company obviously plans to challenge at this point, and as well, they say that this is an obvious example that patent reform needs to happen in a serious way. What is... just related to the case itself, what was Apple's defense against kind of the charges that were brought to them?
Well, anytime you're sued for patent infringement, you say two things. One, we didn't infringe it. Our technology is different. And the other thing you say is these patents aren't valid. And I think actually Apple told me at the patent office they've successfully challenged them, but that part of the evidence couldn't come into this lawsuit. And so it just sort of became another crazy patent verdict.
So Apple just always challenges it, and then the patent troll, until the patent troll runs out of money, why did Microsoft they settled with this company, with Vernetex? Why did they settle?
Right, and there you go. I mean, you couldn't even pronounce the company's name because it doesn't make any products. It's just sort of a group of lawyers sitting in Nevada.
Yeah.
The way it works on the inside is if you're, because these companies get sued all the time. I mean, Apple gets sued hundreds of times for these patent trolls. And what they do inside, it's almost a question of economics. You add up the numbers, how much will it cost us to go fly to East Texas a whole bunch of times, maybe lose, maybe go to appeal. And then if the number's low enough, you just pay the troll to go away. Some companies will fight and try to stomp the troll, but often it's just a matter of like, this is just a cost of doing business.
Right.
So that's, you know, seems to be what happened here.
Mm. All All right, let's move on to another story that you published this week. Now, those of us on the front lines who gave up our cable subscription years ago, that's me. I just use Netflix and Amazon Prime, been doing it for a long time. We usually have one thing in common. We don't care about sports.
Oh.
But I know. But now that cord cutting has become mainstream, the networks have to do something about it. They have to keep up with the time. So for Sunday's Super Bowl, you could go to a party, one of your friends who still has cable, or you can download the CBS app on your Apple TV or your Chromecast or Xbox. Now, all those deals have been worked out, but what if you wanted to watch the first Super Bowl? Who owns the copyright for that, Jeff?
Oh, this is a crazy story. A great piece of reporting in the New York Times. There's one guy sitting in, where is he? Oh, nice football. Didn't expect that. It's a guy sitting, I think he's in upstate New York or something, and his dad in 1967 had something called a Quadermatics machine. It's like an early VCR that recorded the very first Super Bowl, and it's the only copy out there. I mean, even the networks don't have it. The NFL doesn't have it, and it sat in this attic for like 40, 50 years, and now it's out there, and he wants to sell it. But so it's sort of fascinating. It's got like, you know, real cigarette commercials in it. It's got like Vince Lombardi close-ups. It's, you know, sort of a piece of American history. And sports historians call it sort of the holy grail of like this lost sports image. And suddenly it's back.
And so they describe this machine. It's like he went and he took two big rolls of tape and then this machine, and you know, it was sitting in someone's attic. And, you know, the guy who did it passed it on to his son, like who I guess he was a bit estranged from, saying, you know, maybe this can pay for you in college. And you see in his picture, if you're watching the video, that he is no longer in college. And now what's happening? I mean, now who is trying to fight against him? Is it the NFL or is it CBS?
No, it's about who owns that copyright. It's sort of like if you tape something over the air, you're allowed to watch it privately. But back then, you had to put a copyright sticker on stuff to show it's yours. Now you don't have to. And it's not clear that anyone ever claimed that copyright. And especially in over-the-air signals back then, too, the copyright law was different. And also, I mean, the NFL, of course, you know, every time the NFL sees a threat, it's like, we own it all, we're going to sue you. But in this case, they haven't registered anything in the copyright office. If you want to sue someone for copyright, you have to put what's called a deposit copy with the copyright office. And that's what gets you into court and makes you, you know, and then you can really go after people. But the NFL hasn't done that. And the reason is they don't own a copy. So it's just a sort of really funny quirk. And I guess the guy tried to sell it to them for $1 million. And they said, forget it, we'll give you $30,000. And then, you know, it's the NFL. It's, you know, you don't want to tangle with the NFL's lawyers. But that's where it stands now. So this thing should be on YouTube for us all to watch. But I guess this guy's just going to keep it in his basement for now.
Oh. Yeah, that is so weird that you can't. You're saying I have the copyright, but you don't own any of it. That's crazy. And I guess he was going to tell his story at the Super Bowl, like on to CBS, and NFL said no, don't pay him to do this.
$1 million isn't that much for the NFL. I mean, seriously, just imagine how much money they could make after all this time, no one seeing, no one having access to this, and then suddenly everybody does. If the NFL paid $1 million up front, they'd make so much more than that off of this. It's really surprising that they held stood their ground at $30,000.
Yeah,
it's kind of crazy. Mm-hmm. I want to see this. Like, I don't know.
Well, you may be able to. It may own.
I know.
It may belong to no one, right?
Shoot.
Yeah, I mean, what I want the guy to do is just put it on the internet the NFL or CBS hasn't registered a copyright, you know, what are they going to do to him? Well, they'll probably sue him anyways, and you know, but it's a shame. I hope it comes out. You know, I don't know if this guy deserves to be a millionaire, but you know, I agree with you, Jason, that you know, $1 million is nothing for the NFL. So, but you know, teams spend money in way stupider ways than that. So.
I mean, if it doesn't exist anywhere else, then great. That guy makes $1 million because he happened to be, it's like kind of like winning the lottery. But everybody wins, right? So there you go. Yeah. Hey, Jeff John Roberts, I know you have to take off. Thank you so much for coming on and joining us for the show today. We really appreciate it. Tell people where they can kind of follow your work, what you're working on, all that kind of stuff online.
Come check out Fortune's tech page. We got some great writers. We're building a bigger... a bigger tech team, and you're going to see some other big names coming soon. So yeah, come check us out or follow me on Twitter if you like geeky copyright and patent stuff. But Jason, Megan, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure. We'll have you back soon.
Take care, Jeff.
Cool. Take care, guys.
Take care.
All right, it's time for our weekly gaming check-in with Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica. Last week, we told you about a few of the HTC Vive games that Sam played, but we missed a few. Sam, are you there?
I am here. Hello, hello. Happy Friday to y'all.
Happy Friday. Thanks for coming on. So what is coming next to our VR goggles?
Oh, goodness. Where do I begin? Do you want me to start with the one where you walk around a walk pit? Do you want me to talk about the paintbrush app? Do you want me to talk about mini golf?
I want you to talk about the one that you like. You did that stood above the rest that you said, oh my goodness, I see the future right now.
I think we talked about the paintbrush last week. Didn't we talk a little bit about the paintbrush app?
We did. Tilt Brush has been sort of cooking for a while. Google's been working on that. They picked up the team that's been working on that one. But it's really hard because the event I went to, which had a dozen demos at all, had so many different ones where every time I went, wow, it couldn't be topped, it got topped.
Wow.
But I would say at the top of my list, there's something called Audio Shield, which absolutely blew me away. Now, the team working on this one made something called Audio Surf, which took your MP3s and turned them into Guitar Hero-like levels. Meaning you didn't have to wait for someone to license Led Zeppelin or any of these other big acts to have that one. They unfortunately haven't released any video of their current project. So you get this kind of weird-looking screen over there with a bunch of blue and orange stuff. But it's unbelievable in action. You take a song, you pick it, it starts loading it, and you look up and you see all these blue and orange orbs coming at you from the sky. And in your hands, because you're holding these little Wii-like remotes, blue and orange. And you have to punch the blue and orange globes that are coming down from the sky to the beat of the music. As the music gets more intense, the angle changes and the percussion changes and where you need to point at. Sometimes it's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to the beat. Sometimes it's a little slower. It's very good. I was so impressed for something that's not even out yet to be so good at analyzing music to make that feeling happen. On the flip side, another game that really blew me away was called Hover Junkers, which is the first ever walkpit game, cockpit that you walk around. Now, with these virtual reality systems, the HTC Vive in particular, this is the system, by the way, that lets you walk around. You're not sitting in a chair. You're expected to walk around a full room. And so you can't really do Call of Duty in something like this. Call of Duty expects you to walk all over a giant battlefield. The way they fix this is that you in your walking space in real life is about 9 feet by 12 feet. That 9 feet by 12 feet appears in virtual space as a cockpit. And you walk around, you use one hand to steer your way around. You use your other hand to point and shoot a gun. And you're driving around this desert landscape, hiding behind cover, holding your gun out, bam, 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 shooting some other guy who's playing on the internet. And then using your free hand to either steer around to get around the person or using that hand to grab junk from the battlefield like this guy's doing right here and putting it on your cockpit so you can then hide behind the thing that you pick up. It's just unreal that this sort of inventive treatment to coming up with a way to feel like you're in crazy high-tech laser tag. That's only scratching the surface. I haven't even started talking about mini golf for crying out loud.
Wait, I need to stop you before the mini golf. This room-sized VR, do you have a room that you can dedicate to VR, Sam?
As soon as I finished playing all this, I went crazy finding the exact spot in my house, and I found it. I've totally laid it out, moved stuff around. But like I said, they've added a webcam. So when you do actually have it, you'll be able, while you have this thing on, to see stuff around you.
Oh,
so that you don't, as crazy as you may look, you can still go, oh, wait, someone's about to prank on me. It'll like pop up with a little webcam feed in your virtual world.
That's what I wondered about that video we were just watching, because he was not in an empty room by any means. There was stuff all around it. I was like, okay, soon he's going to be so lost in the game that he's going to like run into a computer and knock it off the shelf or something.
I talked about a bunch. Please go to Ars Technica. It's one of my biggest features from the past week about all these and going in at length. There's just a lot coming, a lot of inventive people, a lot of young people making games that are just really pushing the boundaries of stuff that's not even out yet. This HTC Vive system is expected to come out at the end of April this year. If that happens, I'd be pleasantly surprised, because until something is in my hands, I wonder. But cool stuff.
So now do tell us about why we need VR mini golf.
VR mini golf... I think what was so cool about this, because you say that, with the Wii, I batted around and golfed like that before. But I was actually really pleasantly surprised by this crazy, fantastical VR golf world. I was on top of a mountain, and I go, well, where's my ball going to go when I putt it? And I walk to the edge of the room and look over the edge of a cliff, and I can see the trail that it would go around, and was able to aim my shot accordingly and get a hole in one. It was that sort of weird moment that was so easy that the guy handed it to me and said, I don't have to tell you what to do. It's mini golf. There was no instruction manual. It was just the muscle feeling of using my hand to putt in VR. It's one of those things that once you do it, you really do drink the Kool-Aid. It is hard to show off in a screenshot. It's hard to show in a video. That feeling of being totally immersed, of all the sounds in your ears matching up, of all the visuals matching up as you walk around, it's been nailed. It's impressive stuff. It's going to be expensive, and that's going to be a big problem. But people like me are going to be at the front lines, holding, you know, $1,000 in their hand, saying, all right, that's my entertainment budget. I'm just, you know, not going to eat food for a couple months while I live in this weird virtual cocoon.
I was a gamer of the days of yesteryear, and then I've taken a long break from like considering myself any sort of hardcore gamer for years and years. I have a feeling I'm going to totally get into VR. Like, it is the really strange feeling. Like, hearing you talk about it gets me so excited about the possibilities of VR.
I have problems. Cool. I'm losing friends left and right. They're all like,
I guess that's the downside.
We'll see you next year.
Yeah. Now, speaking of VR, the Unreal Engine is getting all VR-y. Is that right?
That is right. I got a call earlier this week saying, we have an announcement about VR. And I said, Unreal, you're already powering some VR games. Unfortunately, there's a lot of these engines that people use to generate stuff for their video games. Unreal's sort of fallen behind compared to something called Unity. So they came back and said, okay, we're going to make a what you see is what you get VR game maker. The idea being you've started making a game with your 2D computer, making some art assets and all this sort of thing. You want to try it out. Put on a headset, and then you can be inside of the game that you're still making.
Wow.
And you're like a puppeteer. This video here is showing someone who's bouncing back and forth between being inside the game and being a puppeteer. He looks kind of like a maniac if you watch him move his head around, his hands around. But he's so able to quickly grab stuff in 3D space and go, I need this to be here. I need it to be this size. He even can pull up a little virtual iPad to ship for other menu commands and advanced options, so that while he's in the VR space, he doesn't have to return to the keyboard and mouse, that he can live in this VR space and feel what it's like to be in the virtual world he's creating. When I talk to the guys, this is from Epic Games. They've been making games forever, including the Gears of War series. They said that they already have totally bitten the VR bullet. They really want a world in which everything they use, including Windows, can just work in VR. It's that one guy described it as, these are motions I do 1,000 times in, you know, a few hours of having to move stuff around. And doing so with my hands as opposed to a weird mouse, it means that I'm doing all the 3D stuff immediately. I don't have to use keyboard shortcuts to change X, Y, and Z axis stuff. I am immediately moving things around in 3D. This is the sort of thing that if people who are making all of our 3D experiences are going VR crazy, the people who are going to be playing them, I think, are going to follow suit.
Yeah, well, watching this a little bit, I see a little bit of kind of like jitter with the controls.
Absolutely.
That would bug me over time.
This is an earlier version, and actually one of the coolest things about the HTC Vive, the newer version, is that they've really done a lot to get that judder down. In fact, there's some sacrifices in order to get that judder effect away, because that's such a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. The experience I had, because that's with an older version, assuming they really do nail the judder, that's going to be a really crucial thing to making people love VR. It's pretty cool.
So last week we talked about the release of The Witness by Jonathan Braid. It cost $40, which is a little steep. How did it do in its first week?
He actually did a surprising thing and came out and told as many financial details as he could. Jonathan Blow made the game Braid in 2008, and this was sort of the beginning of the buy things online era. Before that, you know, Best Buy was still a thing that people actually went to. The App Store was brand new at that point. And the idea of paying $15 for a game that didn't come in a box was sort of blowing people's minds. Now there's been sort of this race to the bottom where if a game at the App Store costs more than $3, it can struggle to really show up on sales charts, even, no matter how big it is. Jonathan Blow came out and said, you know what, even though this is online only, even though I made it as a small indie team, I worked on it for 6 years, I'm going to charge $40 a pop. He says that in the first week of sales, it already outsold that 2008 game, which he said was a raging success. $5 million in revenue, over 100,000 copies. for a game that he said, all right, I'm going to charge $40 and see what happens. He also had a lot to say about piracy and about the ideas that games are often really pirated, but that people will still come out and buy. And he had actually worried about piracy before the game came out. As of now, that hasn't been a worry. And it looks like him coming out and saying, I can make something, price it at $40, and do well, may actually be a wake-up call for other game makers and app sellers who have been freaking out about the idea of selling stuff for too much. I could see this year being a big return to people stopping and adding value back to the prices of their things and saying, you want my game, you have to pay some money for it.
Good. I like that a little better. Mm-hmm. A new strategy release this week improves upon previous sequels and kind of ramps up the style factor. Tell us a little bit about what to look forward to with XCOM 2.
XCOM 2 launched this week. Actually, today, we happened to get a copy of it a couple of weeks ago. That was our critic, Rowan Kaiser. He's a huge fan of what to expect. There's a lot more cool stuff with the aliens in the game. I actually only got my copy today. Very excited about losing my entire weekend to it. But what you end up with is the tactical stuff that XCOM totally came back with a few years ago. It's just feels so huge. They really managed to add a really cool alien plot to this XCOM. I'm really into the customization you have with your squad mates. When I start talking about this, I feel like I'm sounding like a kid geeking out on, you know, a little military tool set. So I worry about using a lot of the language and stuff. But basically, XCOM 2 is not a game for people who haven't necessarily played XCOM. That might be the biggest diss I might offer, is that you want to be sort of steeped in this love of X-Files style espionage, of military battling, of working with squad mates, of these really hardcore battles where when someone dies, they die forever. But if that kind of game sounds really good to you, there's a lot of game to dig into. We highly recommend it at Ars Technica. Get down with XCOM 2.
Well, Sam, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Yeah. And go to arstechnica.com and read all of his work. He reports on the games, just the love of them, the gaming culture, everything about gaming. It's amazing. And Sam is also at Sam Red on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on. We'll see you next Friday.
Thanks for having me. I'm going to go dive into some video games while everyone else talks about this bowl. It's a bowl something? I don't know. I'm going to go fight aliens. That seems just as silly to me.
You're going to go play Madden, aren't you? Yeah. Yeah, maybe. Okay, all right. All right, see you later, Sam. Thank you. All right. And thank you, Brian, for that. Excellent. Coming up, just what you've always wanted, a live stream of a computer beating someone at Go. No, seriously, this could be totally awesome. I think I want to watch this. But first, let's take a minute to thank FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer, you run a small business, chances are your least favorite part is kind of, you know, tearing through those receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, sending, formatting invoices, tweaking them to no end, tracking down customers who don't pay you on time. You got to hate that one. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software. It's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. I've done my own invoices in the past. I know what life is like without FreshBooks. It's a pain. I got to find which template I'm going to use, craft it around my own needs. It almost always takes way longer than I really wanted it to because I've got other work to do. Then I have to get it to the right people and wait to get paid, wondering if I missed some critical step along the way. Not with FreshBooks. That's what FreshBooks does for you. Getting started on FreshBooks could not be easier. Even if you're not a numbers person, I'm not a numbers person. There you go. You'll be creating and sending invoices in minutes and get paid online right away with FreshBooks payments. You get paid up front, so now you can request a deposit in FreshBooks. No covering cost out of pocket or waiting until the end of a project to get paid. Plus, FreshBooks recently announced their new card reader, so you can easily accept credit cards wherever business happens to take you, quickly, securely, right from your iPhone in less than a minute. FreshBooks card reader is EMV, that's chip card enabled, which is the new standard in the U.S. With their entirely redesigned iPhone app, you can actually conduct business anywhere you happen to be. You can send an estimate right after the handshake, send an invoice in seconds right on your phone. It's so easy to track all of your billable time, so you'll know exactly how long your projects actually take, and you can throw away that shoebox you've been storing all those receipts in. Track expenses on the spot using your phone's camera. All of this allows you to focus on what you love the most, and that's growing your business, the most important part. You'll wonder why you didn't start with FreshBooks sooner. And finally, if you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. So getting started is simple. It's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/TNT. Don't forget to enter Tech News Today in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Let them know that you heard about it by watching this show or listening to the show. And start your 30-day free trial today. We thank FreshBooks for supporting this episode of Tech News Today. All right, TNT's fan of the day is Chris Branch, who says, "I'm an indie game developer, and you get a full monitor right above the code." That's right. We are important enough to get a full monitor right above the code so that his eyes don't have to go very far away from what he's focusing on. All he has to do is glance up and see us talking tech. That is dedication. He says, "Thanks for making it a great show." He also says his goal is to get his game into the App Arena, which is, you know, another show that I do, to which I say, "Chris, send it to arena@twit.tv, and I will take a look." And also, hey, if you want to share with us how you watch or listen, send that to TNT. Just record a video, take a picture of yourself, your setup, all that stuff. Post it to Instagram, Google+, Twitter, Facebook, anywhere else. Email it. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and hopefully we will find it.
Mm-hmm. You can Snapchat it. We're on Snapchat now.
You can snap it. Mm-hmm. You can snap it to us.
Mm-hmm. Draw a little mustache on Jason, and you're
done. Do those weird little, like, you've seen those video filters where they take your face and they squish it down and it's like...
They're called lenses.
Like, oh, the lenses. Oh, they're creepy.
I love them.
Talk about creepy. They're okay. Weird. But I want to play with them because they're also fun. Kind of awesome.
They are awesome. Yeah. All right. Here's an update to a story that we reported last week, that Google's DeepMind, that's their AI department, DeepMind had beaten the European champion at the ancient game of Go. The computer was called AlphaGo. Now Google plans to live stream AlphaGo's next match or next series of matches on YouTube. The games will be against the highest ranking Go player in the world, Lee Sedol. So this is interesting. So it's going to be live streamed, which I will assume that Google is doing that knowing that it's going to win, because that would be embarrassing for Google and DeepMind if they lost.
You don't know. You're playing against a human.
You don't
know. This human might be just, he's the best Go player that's existed in the last 10 years. So he's really, really, really good.
He's not the European champion. Know. That's what we reported last time.
This is the next step up. And what I'm realizing is Go and AI is kind of like in this weird, like, world wrestling thing. Like, I call you out, AI, whatever this is called, open mind or whatever. Deep or mind? AlphaGo. There AlphaGo. We go. AlphaGo, I choose you to a battle of Go.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a little less theatrical than world wrestling, but... one can dream.
Yeah, I mean, in case you missed the episode that we were talking about this, Go is way more complicated than chess. So, you know, this is more like Kasparov versus, you know, the Watson computer, rather than the one we reported last week, was only the European champion. I will be watching it.
Now, if Google does, if AlphaGo does lose, is that a sign to others that Google's AI project is just not up to snuff?
I don't know. I mean, they also have to hand over $1 million, which is really nothing for them. But I don't know. I mean, it won't look good for them. But then also there's this idea that it is a little frightening for us whenever, you know, we lose to, you know, we humans.
Whenever the best race can't win against
loses
a robot.
To a computer.
Yeah.
It is scary for us. So I guess maybe that's what they're betting on.
Yeah. Sundar Pichai did call out the victory of the last game at Google's, or Alphabet's rather, earnings report. Last week. So Google's kind of feeling pretty good about their AI right now. So it would be interesting to see if they actually ended up losing.
Maybe we should have a Go standoff. You and I should play.
Like, I think it takes like hours to play.
Well, we got hours, right?
Do we?
No, we don't.
You know, after the show, we just hang around for hours.
There we are now playing. That's what we usually do after the... No,
they
kind of
just look.
Hours.
You know what they kind of look like to me? They kind of look like Mentos, and I just want to eat them. Sorry. I got a laugh out of Brian. Yay, I win. All right, that is it. And on that note, Do you have a Mento, by the way? Because I could really go for one.
I don't have. Okay. I have a sriracha roasted cashew.
Oh, that's a good.
Use.
That's a good.
We should
option.
Play Go with NatureBox next.
All right,
let's do that.
All right, let's figure that out. Monday's guest will be Kurt Wagner from Recode. Kurt's awesome. It'll be great to get him on for a full episode. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. Send us a ton of email this week. I want to come back on Monday and just be like, oh, too many emails.
Mm-hmm.
Do that, please. You can also hit us up on Twitter at TechNewsTodayTV.
And if you like us in your email, you can sign up for our regular missives at twit.tv/newsletter. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast catcher, too. All of the ways to subscribe are there on our show page at twit.tv/TNT. Join us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/TechNewsTodayTV. Don't forget the TV on the end of that.
Important.
Mm-hmm. And on Twitter, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I am at Jason Howell. Thanks to our live producer, Brian Burnett. And all the folks who help us make this show every single day. We will see you next Monday on another episode of Tech News Today. Have a good weekend, everybody.